She was left to bear the whole cost of her resistance. Hang it, if he could find a way out of such difficulties for a professional sponge like Carrie Fisher, who was simply a mental habit corresponding to the physical titillations of the cigarette or the cocktail, he could surely do as much for a girl who appealed to his highest sympathies and who brought her troubles to him with the trustfulness of a child. Trenor and Miss Bart prolonged their drive till long after sunset, and before it was over he had tried, with some show of success, to prove to her that if she would only trust him, he could make a handsome sum of money for her without endangering the small amount she possessed. She was too genuinely ignorant of the manipulations of the stock market to understand his technical explanations, or even perhaps to perceive that certain points in them were slurred. The haziness enveloping the transaction served as a veil for her embarrassment, and through the general blur her hopes dilated like lamps in a fog. She understood only that her modest investments were to be mysteriously multiplied without risk to herself, and the assurance that this miracle would take place within a short time, that there would be no tedious interval for suspense and reaction, relieved her of her lingering scruples. Again she felt the lightening of her load, and with it the release of repressed activities. Her immediate worries conjured, it was easy to resolve that she would never again find herself in such straits. And as the need of economy and self-denial receded from her foreground, she felt herself ready to meet any other demand which life might make. Even the immediate one of letting Trenor, as they drove homeward, lean a little nearer and rest his hand reassuringly on hers, cost her only a momentary shiver of reluctance. It was part of the game to make him feel that her appeal had been an uncalculated impulse provoked by the liking he inspired, and the renewed sense of power in handling men, while it consoled her wounded vanity, helped also to obscure the thought of the claim at which his manner hinted. He was a coarse, dull man, who under all his show of authority was a mere supernumerary in the costly show for which his money paid. Surely, to a clever girl, it would be easy to hold him by his vanity, and so keep the obligation on his side. Chapter 8. The first $1,000 check which Lily received with a blotted scrawl from Gus Trenor strengthened her self-confidence in the exact degree to which it effaced her debts. The transaction had justified itself by its results. She saw now how absurd it would have been to let any primitive scruple deprive her of this easy means of appeasing her creditors. Lily felt really virtuous as she dispensed the sum in sops to her tradesmen, and the fact that a fresh order accompanied each payment did not lessen her sense of disinterestedness. How many women in her place would have given the orders without making the payment? She had found it reassuringly easy to keep Trenor in a good humour, to listen to his stories, to receive his confidences and laugh at his jokes, seemed for the moment all that was required of her, and the complacency with which her hostess regarded these attentions freed them of the least hint of ambiguity. Mrs. Trenor evidently assumed that Lily's growing intimacy with her husband was simply an indirect way of returning her own kindness. "I'm so glad you and Gus have become such good friends," she said approvingly. "It's too delightful of you to be so nice to him and put up with all his tiresome stories. I know what they are because I had to listen to him when we were engaged. I'm sure he's telling the same ones still. And now I shan't always be having to ask Carrie Fisher here to keep him in a good humour. She's a perfect vulture, you know, and she hasn't the least moral sense. She's always getting Gus to speculate for her, and I'm sure she never pays when she loses." Miss Bart could shudder at this state of things without the embarrassment of a personal application. Her own position was surely quite different. There could be no question of her not paying when she lost, since Trenor had assured her that she was certain not to lose. In sending her the cheque, he had explained that he had made $5,000 for her out of Rosedale's tip, and put $4,000 back in the same venture, as there was a promise of another big rise. She understood, therefore, that he was now speculating with her own money, and that she consequently owed him no more than the gratitude which such a trifling service demanded. She vaguely supposed that to raise the first sum he had borrowed on her securities, but this was a point over which her curiosity did not linger. It was concentrated, for the moment, on the probable date of the next big rise. The news of this event was received by her some weeks later on the occasion of Jack Stepney's marriage to Miss Van Osburg. As a cousin of the bridegroom, Miss Bart had been asked to act as a bridesmaid, but she had declined, on the plea that since she was much taller than the other attendant virgins, her presence might mar the symmetry of the group. The truth was, she had attended too many brides to the altar. When next seen there, she meant to be the chief figure in the ceremony. She knew the pleasantries made at the expense of young girls who have been too long before the public, and she was resolved to avoid such assumptions of youthfulness as might lead people to think her older than she really was. The Van Osburg marriage was celebrated in the village church near the paternal estate on the Hudson. It was the simple country wedding to which guests are conveyed in special trains, and from which the hordes of the uninvited have to be fended off by the intervention of the police. While these sylvan rites were taking place in a church packed with fashion and festooned with orchids, the representatives of the press were threading their way, notebook in hand, through the labyrinth of wedding presents, and the agent of a cinematograph syndicate was setting up his apparatus at the church door. It was the kind of scene in which Lily had often pictured herself as taking the principal part. And on this occasion, the fact that she was once more merely a casual spectator, instead of the mystically veiled figure occupying the center of attention, strengthened her resolve to assume the latter part before the year was over. The fact that her immediate anxieties were relieved did not blind her to a possibility of their recurrence. It merely gave her enough buoyancy to rise once more above her doubts and feel a renewed faith in her beauty, her power, and her general fitness to attract a brilliant destiny. It could not be that one conscious of such aptitudes for mastery and enjoyment was doomed to a perpetuity of failure, and her mistakes looked easily reparable in the light of her restored self-confidence. A special appositeness was given to these reflections by the discovery in a neighbouring pew of the serious profile and neatly trimmed beard of Mr. Percy Gryce. There was something almost bridal in his own aspect. His large white gardenia had a symbolic air that struck Lily as a good omen. After all, seen in an assemblage of his kind, he was not ridiculous-looking. A friendly critic might have called his heaviness weighty, and he was at his best in the attitude of vacant passivity which brings out the oddities of the restless. She fancied he was the kind of man whose sentimental associations would be stirred by the conventional imagery of a wedding, and she pictured herself, in the seclusion of the Van Osburg conservatories, playing skilfully upon sensibilities thus prepared for her touch. In fact, when she looked at the other women about her and recalled the image she had brought away from her own glass, it did not seem as though any special skill would be needed to repair her blunder and bring him once more to her feet. The sight of Selden's dark head in a pew almost facing her disturbed for a moment the balance of her complacency. The rise of her blood as their eyes met was succeeded by a contrary motion, a wave of resistance and withdrawal. She did not wish to see him again, not because she feared his influence, but because his presence always had the effect of cheapening her aspirations, of throwing her whole world out of focus. Besides, he was a living reminder of the worst mistake in her career, and the fact that he had been its cause did not soften her feelings toward him. She could still imagine an ideal state of existence, in which, all else being superadded, intercourse with Selden might be the last touch of luxury. But in the world as it was, such a privilege was likely to cost more than it was worth. "Lily, dear, I never saw you look so lovely. You look as if something delightful had just happened to you." The young lady who thus formulated her admiration of her brilliant friend did not in her own person suggest such happy possibilities. Miss Gertrude Farish, in fact, typified the mediocre and the ineffectual. If there were compensating qualities in her wide, frank glance and the freshness of her smile, these were qualities which only the sympathetic observer would perceive, before noticing that her eyes were of a workaday grey and her lips without haunting curves. Lily's own view of her wavered between pity for her limitations and impatience at her cheerful acceptance of them. To Miss Bart, as to her mother, acquiescence in dinginess was evidence of stupidity, and there were moments when, in the consciousness of her own power to look and to be so exactly what the occasion required, she almost felt that other girls were plain and inferior from choice. Certainly no one need have confessed such acquiescence in her lot as was revealed in the useful colour of Gertie Farish's gown and the subdued lines of her hat. It is almost as stupid to let your clothes betray that you know you are ugly as to have them proclaim that you think you are beautiful. Of course, being fatally poor and dingy, it was wise of Gertie to have taken up philanthropy and symphony concerts. But there was something irritating in her assumption that existence yielded no higher pleasures, and that one might get as much interest and excitement out of life in a cramped flat as in the splendours of the Van Osburgh establishment. Today, however, her chirping enthusiasms did not irritate Lily. They seemed only to throw her own exceptionalness into becoming relief and give a soaring vastness to her scheme of life. "Do let us go and take a peep at the presents before everyone else leaves the dining room," suggested Miss Farish, linking her arm in her friend's. It was characteristic of her to take a sentimental and unenvious interest in all the details of a wedding. She was the kind of person who always kept her handkerchief out during the service and departed clutching a box of wedding cake. "Isn't everything beautifully done?" she pursued, as they entered the distant drawing-room assigned to the display of Miss Van Osburgh's bridal spoils. "I always say no one does things better than Cousin Grace. Did you ever taste anything more delicious than that mousse of lobster with champagne sauce? I made up my mind weeks ago that I wouldn't miss this wedding, and just fancy how delightfully it all came about. When Lawrence Selden heard I was coming, he insisted on fetching me himself and driving me to the station, and when we go back this evening, I am to dine with him at Sherry's. I really feel as excited as if I were getting married myself." Lily smiled. She knew that Selden had always been kind to his dull cousin, and she'd sometimes wondered why he wasted so much time in such an unremunerative manner. But now the thought gave her a vague pleasure. "Do you see him often?" she asked. "Yes, he's very good about dropping in on Sundays, and now and then we do a play together. But lately I haven't seen much of him. He doesn't look well, and he seems nervous and unsettled. The dear fellow! I do wish he would marry some nice girl. I told him so today. But he said he didn't care for the really nice ones, and the other kind didn't care for him. But that was just his joke, of course. He could never marry a girl who wasn't nice." "Oh, my dear, did you ever see such pearls?" They had paused before the table on which the bride's jewels were displayed, and Lily's heart gave an envious throb as she caught the refraction of light from their surfaces, the milky gleam of perfectly matched pearls, the flash of rubies relieved against contrasting velvet, the intense blue rays of sapphires kindled into light by surrounding diamonds. All these precious tints enhanced and deepened by the varied art of their setting. The glow of the stones warmed Lily's veins like wine. More completely than any other expression of wealth, they symbolized the life she longed to lead, the life of fastidious aloofness and refinement, in which every detail should have the finish of a jewel, and the whole form a harmonious setting to her own jewel-like rareness. "Oh, Lily! Do look at this diamond pendant. It's as big as a dinner plate. Who can have given it?" Miss Farish bent short-sightedly over the accompanying card. "Mr. Simon Rosedale." "What, that horrid man? Oh, yes, I remember he's a friend of Jack's, and I suppose Cousin Grace had to ask him here today. But she must rather hate having to let Gwen accept such a present from him." Lily smiled. She doubted Mrs. Van Osburgh's reluctance, but was aware of Miss Farish's habit of ascribing her own delicacies of feeling to the persons least likely to be encumbered by them. "Well, if Gwen doesn't care to be seen wearing it, she can always exchange it for something else," she remarked. "Ah, here is something so much prettier," Miss Farish continued. "Do look at this exquisite white sapphire. I'm sure the person who chose it must have taken particular pains. What is the name?" "Percy Grice. Ah, then I'm not surprised." She smiled significantly as she replaced the card. "Of course you've heard that he's perfectly devoted to Evie Van Osburgh. Cousin Grace is so pleased about it. It's quite a romance. He met her first at the George Dorsets only about 6 weeks ago, and it's just the nicest possible marriage for dear Evie. Oh, I don't mean the money. Of course she's plenty of her own. But she's such a quiet, stay-at-home kind of girl, and it seems he has just the same tastes, so they are exactly suited to each other." Lily stood staring vacantly at the white sapphire on its velvet bed. Evie Van Osburgh and Percy Gryce. The names rang derisively through her brain. Evie Van Osburgh, the youngest, dumpiest, dullest of the four dull and dumpy daughters whom Mrs. Van Osburgh, with unsurpassed astuteness, had placed, one by one, in enviable niches of existence. Ah, lucky girls, who grow up in the shelter of a mother's love, a mother who knows how to contrive opportunities without conceding favours, how to take advantage of propinquity without allowing appetite to be dulled by habit. The cleverest girl may miscalculate where her own interests are concerned, may yield too much at one moment and withdraw too far at the next. It takes a mother's unerring vigilance and foresight to land her daughters safely in the arms of wealth and suitability. Lily's passing light-heartedness sank beneath a renewed sense of failure. Life was too stupid, too blundering. Why should Percy Gryce's millions be joined to another great fortune? Why should this clumsy girl be put in possession of powers she would never know how to use? She was roused from these speculations by a familiar touch on her arm, and turning, saw Gus Trenor beside her. She felt a thrill of vexation. What right had he to touch her? Luckily, Gertie Farish had wandered off to the next table, and they were alone. Trenor, looking stouter than ever in his tight frock coat, and unbecomingly flushed by the bridal libations, gazed at her with undisguised approval. "By Jove, Lily, you do look a stunner!" He had slipped insensibly into the use of her Christian name, and she had never found the right moment to correct him. Besides, in her set, all the men and women called each other by their Christian names. It was only on Trenor's lips that the familiar address had an unpleasant significance. "Well," he continued, still jovially impervious to her annoyance, "have you made up your mind which of these little trinkets you mean to duplicate at Tiffany's tomorrow? I've got a check for you in my pocket that will go a long way in that line." Lily gave him a startled look. His voice was louder than usual, and the room was beginning to fill with people. But as her glance assured her that they were still beyond earshot, a sense of pleasure replaced her apprehension. "Another dividend?" she asked, smiling and drawing near him, in the desire not to be overheard.
"Well, not exactly. I sold out on the rise, and I've pulled off 4,000 for you. Not so bad for a beginner, eh? I suppose you'll begin to think you're a pretty knowing speculator. And perhaps you won't think poor old Gus such an awful ass as some people do."
"I think you the kindest of friends, but I can't thank you properly now." She let her eyes shine into his with a look that made up for the handclasp he would have claimed if they'd been alone, and how glad she was that they were not. The news filled her with the glow produced by a sudden cessation of physical pain. The world was not so stupid and blundering after all. Now and then a stroke of luck came to the unluckiest. At the thought her spirits began to rise. It was characteristic of her that one trifling piece of good fortune should give wing to all her hopes. Instantly came the reflection that Percy Gryce was not irretrievably lost, and she smiled to think of the excitement of recapturing him from Evie Van Osburgh. What chance could such a simpleton have against her if she chose to exert herself? She glanced about, hoping to catch a glimpse of Gryce, but her eyes lit instead on the glossy countenance of Mr. Rosedale, who was slipping through the crowd with an air half-obsequious, half-obtrusive, as though the moment his presence was recognized, it would swell to the dimensions of the room. Not wishing to be the means of effecting this enlargement, Lily quickly transferred her glance to Trenor, to whom the expression of her gratitude seemed not to have brought the complete gratification she had meant it to give.
"Hang thanking me. I don't want to be thanked. But I should like the chance to say two words to you now and then," he grumbled. "I thought you were going to spend the whole autumn with us, and I've hardly laid eyes on you for the last month. Why can't you come back to Bellarmine this evening? We're all alone, and Judy is as cross as two sticks. Do come and cheer a fellow up. If you say yes, I'll run you over in the motor, and you can telephone your maid to bring your traps from town by the next train."
Lily shook her head with a charming semblance of regret. "I wish I could, but it's quite impossible. My aunt has come back to town, and I must be with her for the next few days."
"Well, I've seen a good deal less of you since we've got to be such pals than I used to when you were Judy's friend," he continued with unconscious penetration.
"When I was Judy's friend? Am I not her friend still? Really, you say the most absurd things. If I were always at Bellamont, you would tire of me much sooner than Judy. But come and see me at my aunt's the next afternoon you're in town. Then we can have a nice, quiet talk, and you can tell me how I had better invest my fortune." It was true that during the last 3 or 4 weeks she had absented herself from Bellamont on the pretext of having other visits to pay. But she now began to feel that the reckoning she had thus contrived to evade had rolled up interest in the interval. The prospect of the nice quiet talk did not appear as all-sufficing to Trenor as she had hoped, and his brows continued to lower as he said,
"Oh, I don't know that I can promise you a fresh tip every day. But there's one thing you might do for me, and that is just to be a little civil to Rosedale. Judy has promised to ask him to dine when we get to town, but I can't induce her to have him at Bellamont. And if you would let me bring him up now, it would make a lot of difference. I don't believe two women have spoken to him this afternoon, and I can tell you, he's a chap it pays to be decent to."
Miss Bart made an impatient movement, but suppressed the words which seemed about to accompany it. After all, this was an unexpectedly easy way of acquitting her debt, and had she not reasons of her own for wishing to be civil to Mr. Rosedale? "Oh, bring him by all means," she said, smiling. "Perhaps I can get a tip out of him on my own account." Trenor paused abruptly, and his eyes fixed themselves on hers with a look which made her change colour.
"I say, you know, you'll please remember he's a blooming bounder," he said.
And with a slight laugh, she turned toward the open window near which they'd been standing. The throng in the room had increased, and she felt a desire for space and fresh air. Both of these she found on the terrace, where only a few men were lingering over cigarettes and liqueur, while scattered couples strolled across the lawn to the autumn-tinted borders of the flower garden. As she emerged, a man moved toward her from the knot of smokers, and she found herself face to face with Selden. The stir of the pulses which his nearness always caused was increased by a slight sense of constraint. They had not met since their Sunday afternoon walk at Bellamont, and that episode was still so vivid to her that she could hardly believe him to be less conscious of it. But his greeting expressed no more than the satisfaction which every pretty woman expects to see reflected in masculine eyes, and the discovery, if distasteful to her vanity, was reassuring to her nerves. Between the relief of her escape from Trenor and the vague apprehension of her meeting with Rosedale, it was pleasant to rest a moment on the sense of complete understanding which Lawrence Selden's manner always conveyed. "This is luck," he said, smiling. "I was wondering if I should be able to have a word with you before the special snatches us away. I came with Gertie Farish and promised not to let her miss the train, but I'm sure she is still extracting sentimental solace from the wedding presents. She appears to regard their number and value as evidence of the disinterested affection of the contracting parties." There was not the least trace of embarrassment in his voice, and as he spoke, leaning slightly against the jamb of the window, and letting his eyes rest on her in the frank enjoyment of her grace, she felt with a faint chill of regret that he had gone back without an effort to the footing on which they had stood before their last talk together. Her vanity was stung by the sight of his unscathed smile. She longed to be to him something more than a piece of sentient prettiness, a passing diversion to his eye and brain, and the longing betrayed itself in her reply. "Ah," she said, "I envy Gertie that power she has of dressing up with romance all our ugly and prosaic arrangements. I have never recovered my self-respect since you showed me how poor and unimportant my ambitions were." The words were hardly spoken when she realized their infelicity. It seemed to her her fate to appear at her worst to Selden. "I thought, on the contrary," he returned lightly, "that I had been the means of proving they were more important to you than anything else." It was as if the eager current of her being had been checked by a sudden obstacle which drove it back upon itself. She looked at him helplessly, like a hurt or frightened child. This real self of hers, which he had the faculty of drawing out of the depths, was so little accustomed to go alone. The appeal of her helplessness touched in him, as it always did, a latent chord of inclination. it would have meant nothing to him to discover that his nearness made her more brilliant. But this glimpse of a twilight mood, to which he alone had the clue, seemed once more to set him in a world apart with her. "At least you can't think worse things of me than you say," she exclaimed with a trembling laugh. But before he could answer, the flow of comprehension between them was abruptly stayed by the reappearance of Gus Trenor, who advanced with Mr. Rosedale in his wake.
"Hang it, Lily, I thought you'd given me the slip. Rosedale and I have been hunting all over for you."
His voice had a note of conjugal familiarity. Miss Bart fancied she detected in Rosedale's eye a twinkling perception of the fact, and the idea turned her dislike of him to repugnance. She returned his profound bow with a slight nod, made more disdainful by the sense of Selden's surprise that she should number Rosedale among her acquaintances. Trenor had turned away, and his companion continued to stand before Miss Bart, alert and expectant, his lips parted in a smile at whatever she might be about to say, and his very back conscious of the privilege of being seen with her. It was the moment for tact, for the quick bridging over of gaps. But Selden still leaned against the window, a detached observer of the scene, and under the spell of his observation Lily felt herself powerless to exert her usual arts. The dread of Selden's suspecting that there was any need for her to propitiate such a man as Rosedale checked the trivial phrases of politeness. Rosedale still stood before her in an expectant attitude, and she continued to face him in silence, her glance just level with his polished baldness. The look put the finishing touch to what her silence implied. He reddened slowly, shifting from one foot to the other, fingered the plump black pearl in his tie, and gave a nervous twist to his mustache. Then, running his eye over her, he drew back, and said with a side glance at Selden,
"Upon my soul, I never saw a more ripping get-up. Is that the last creation of the dressmaker you go to see at the Benedict? If so, I wonder all the other women don't go to it, too."
The words were projected sharply against Lily's silence, and she saw in a flash that her own act had given them their emphasis. In ordinary talk they might have passed unheeded, but following on her prolonged pause, they acquired a special meaning. She felt, without looking, that Selden had immediately seized it, and would inevitably connect the allusion with her visit to himself. The consciousness increased her irritation against Rosedale, but also her feeling that now, if ever, was the moment to propitiate him, hateful as it was to do so in Selden's presence. "How do you know the other women don't go to my dressmaker?" she returned. "You see, I'm not afraid to give her address to my friends." Her glance and accent so plainly included Rosedale in this privileged circle that his small eyes puckered with gratification, and a knowing smile drew up his mustache.
"By Jove, you needn't be," he declared. "You could give him the whole outfit and win at a canter."
"Ah, that's nice of you. And it would be nicer still if you would carry me off to a quiet corner and get me a glass of lemonade or some innocent drink before we all have to rush for the train." She turned away as she spoke, letting him strut at her side through the gathering groups on the terrace, while every nerve in her throbbed with the consciousness of what Selden must have thought of the scene. But under her angry sense of the perverseness of things, and the light surface of her talk with Rosedale, a third idea persisted. She did not mean to leave without an attempt to discover the truth about Percy Gryce. Chance, or perhaps his own resolve, had kept them apart since his hasty withdrawal from Bellamont. But Miss Bart was an expert in making the most of the unexpected, and the distasteful incidents of the last few minutes, the revelation to Selden of precisely that part of her life which she most wished him to ignore, increased her longing for shelter, for escape from such humiliating contingencies. Any definite situation would be more tolerable than this buffeting of chances, which kept her in an attitude of uneasy alertness toward every possibility of life. Indoors, there was a general sense of dispersal in the air, as of an audience gathering itself up for departure after the principal actors had left the stage. But among the remaining groups, Lily could discover neither Gryce nor the youngest Miss Van Osburgh. That both should be missing struck her with foreboding, and she charmed Mr. Rosedale by proposing that they should make their way to the conservatories at the farther end of the house. There were just enough people left in the long suite of rooms to make their progress conspicuous, and Lily was aware of being followed by looks of amusement and interrogation, which glanced off as harmlessly from her indifference as from her companion's self-satisfaction. She cared very little at that moment about being seen with Rosedale. All her thoughts were centred on the object of her search. The latter, however, was not discoverable in the conservatories, and Lily, oppressed by a sudden conviction of failure, was casting about for a way to rid herself of her now superfluous companion, when they came upon Mrs. Van Osburgh, flushed and exhausted, but beaming with the consciousness of duty performed. She glanced at them a moment with the benign but vacant eye of the tired hostess, to whom her guests had become mere whirling spots in a kaleidoscope of fatigue. Then her attention became suddenly fixed, and she seized on Miss Bart with a confidential gesture. "My dear Lily, I haven't had time for a word with you, and now I suppose you're just off. Have you seen Evie? She's been looking everywhere for you. She wanted to tell you her little secret, but I dare say you've guessed it already. The engagement is not to be announced till next week, but you are such a friend of Mr. Grice's that they both wished you to be the first to know of their happiness." Chapter 9. In Mrs. Peniston's youth, fashion had returned to town in October. Therefore, on the 10th day of the month, the blinds of her Fifth Avenue residence were drawn up, and the eyes of the dying gladiator in bronze, who occupied the drawing-room window, resumed their survey of that deserted thoroughfare. The first 2 weeks after her return represented to Mrs. Peniston the domestic equivalent of a religious retreat. She went through the linen and blankets, in the precise spirit of the penitent, exploring the inner folds of conscience. She sought for moths, as the stricken soul seeks for lurking infirmities. The topmost shelf of every closet was made to yield up its secret. Cellar and coal bin were probed to their darkest depths, and as a final stage in the lustral rites, the entire house was swathed in penitential white and deluged with expiatory soapsuds. It was on this phase of the proceedings that Miss Bart entered on the afternoon of her return from the Van Osburgh wedding. The journey back to town had not been calculated to soothe her nerves. Though Evie Van Osburgh's engagement was still officially a secret, it was one of which the innumerable intimate friends of the family were already possessed, and the trainful of returning guests buzzed with illusions and anticipations. Lily was acutely aware of her own part in this drama of innuendo. She knew the exact quality of the amusement the situation evoked. The crude forms in which her friends took their pleasure included a loud enjoyment of such complications, the zest of surprising destiny in the act of playing a practical joke. Lily knew well enough how to bear herself in difficult situations. She had, to a shade, the exact manner between victory and defeat. Every insinuation was shed without an effort by the bright indifference of her manner. But she was beginning to feel the strain of the attitude. The reaction was more rapid, and she lapsed to a deeper self-disgust. As was always the case with her, this moral repulsion found a physical outlet in a quickened distaste for her surroundings. She revolted from the complacent ugliness of Mrs. Peniston's black walnut, from the slippery gloss of the vestibule tiles, and the mingled odour of sapolio and furniture polish that met her at the door. The stairs were still carpetless, and on the way up to her room she was arrested on the landing by an encroaching tide of soapsuds. Gathering up her skirts, she drew aside with an impatient gesture, and as she did so, she had the odd sensation of having already found herself in the same situation, but in different surroundings. It seemed to her that she was again descending the staircase from Selden's rooms, and looking down to remonstrate with the dispenser of the soapy flood, she found herself met by a lifted stare which had once before confronted her under similar circumstances. It was the charwoman of the Benedick, who, resting on crimson elbows, examined her with the same unflinching curiosity, the same apparent reluctance to let her pass. On this occasion, however, Miss Bart was on her own ground. "Don't you see that I wish to go by? Please move your pail," she said sharply. The woman at first seemed not to hear. Then, without a word of excuse, she pushed back her pail and dragged a wet floor-cloth across the landing, keeping her eyes fixed on Lily while the latter swept by. It was insufferable that Mrs. Peniston should have such creatures about the house. and Lily entered her room, resolved that the woman should be dismissed that evening. Mrs. Peniston, however, was at the moment inaccessible to remonstrance. Since early morning she had been shut up with her maid, going over her furs, a process which formed the culminating episode in the drama of household renovation. In the evening also Lily found herself alone, for her aunt, who rarely dined out, had responded to the summons of a Van Alstyne cousin who was passing through town. The house, in its state of unnatural immaculateness and order, was as dreary as a tomb, and as Lily, turning from her brief repast between shrouded sideboards, wandered into the newly uncovered glare of the drawing-room, she felt as though she were buried alive in the stifling limits of Mrs. Peniston's existence. She usually contrived to avoid being at home during the season of domestic renewal. On the present occasion, however, a variety of reasons had combined to bring her to town, and foremost among them was the fact that she had fewer invitations than usual for the autumn. She had so long been accustomed to pass from one country house to another till the close of the holidays brought her friends to town, that the unfilled gaps of time confronting her produced a sharp sense of waning popularity. It was as she had said to Selden. People were tired of her. They would welcome her in a new character, but as Miss Bart, they knew her by heart. She knew herself by heart, too, and was sick of the old story. There were moments when she longed blindly for anything different, anything strange, remote, and untried. But the utmost reach of her imagination did not go beyond picturing her usual life in a new setting. She could not figure herself as anywhere but in a drawing-room, diffusing elegance as a flower sheds perfume. Meanwhile, as October advanced, she had to face the alternative of returning to the Trenners or joining her aunt in town. Even the desolating dullness of New York in October and the soapy discomforts of Mrs. Peniston's interior seemed preferable to what might await her at Bellamont, and with an air of heroic devotion she announced her intention of remaining with her aunt till the holidays. Sacrifices of this nature are sometimes received with feelings as mixed as those which actuate them, and Mrs. Peniston remarked to her confidential maid that if any of the family were to be with her at such a crisis, though for 40 years she had been thought competent to see to the hanging of her own curtains, she would certainly have preferred Miss Grace to Miss Lily. Grace Stepney was an obscure cousin of adaptable manners and vicarious interests who ran in to sit with Mrs. Peniston when Lily dined out too continuously, who played bezique, picked up dropped stitches, read out the deaths from the Times, and sincerely admired the purple satin drawing-room curtains, the dying gladiator in the window, and the 7x5 painting of Niagara, which represented the one artistic excess of Mr. Peniston's temperate career. Mrs. Peniston, under ordinary circumstances, was as much bored by her excellent cousin as the recipient of such services usually is by the person who performs them. She greatly preferred the brilliant and unreliable Lily, who did not know one end of a crochet needle from the other, and had frequently wounded her susceptibilities by suggesting that the drawing-room should be done over. But when it came to hunting for missing napkins, or helping to decide whether the back stairs needed re-carpeting, Grace's judgment was certainly sounder than Lily's. Not to mention the fact that the latter resented the smell of beeswax and brown soap, and behaved as though she thought a house ought to keep clean of itself, without extraneous assistance. Seated under the cheerless blaze of the drawing-room chandelier, Mrs. Peniston never lit the lamps unless there was company. Lily seemed to watch her own figure retreating down vistas of neutral-tinted dullness to a middle age like Grace Stepney's. When she ceased to amuse Judy Trenner and her friends, she would have to fall back on amusing Mrs. Peniston. Whichever way she looked, she saw only a future of servitude to the whims of others, never the possibility of asserting her own eager individuality. A ring at the doorbell, sounding emphatically through the empty house, roused her suddenly to the extent of her boredom. It was as though all the weariness of the past months had culminated in the vacuity of that interminable evening. If only the ring meant a summons from the outer world, a token that she was still remembered and wanted. After some delay, a parlour-maid presented herself, with the announcement that there was a person outside who was asking to see Miss Bart. And on Lily's pressing for a more specific description, she added, "It's Mrs. Haffin, miss. She won't say what she wants." Lily, to whom the name conveyed nothing, opened the door upon a woman in a battered bonnet, who stood firmly planted under the hall light. The glare of the unshaded gas shone familiarly on her pockmarked face, and the reddish baldness visible through thin strands of straw-coloured hair. Lily looked at the charwoman in surprise. "Do you wish to see me?" she asked. "I should like to say a word to you, miss." The tone was neither aggressive nor conciliatory. It revealed nothing of the speaker's errand. Nevertheless, some precautionary instinct warned Lily to withdraw beyond earshot of the hovering parlour-maid. She signed to Mrs. Haffen to follow her into the drawing-room, and closed the door when they had entered. "What is it that you wish?" she inquired. The charwoman, after the manner of her kind, stood with her arms folded in her shawl. Unwinding the latter, she produced a small parcel wrapped in dirty newspaper. "I have something here that you might like to see, Miss Bart." She spoke the name with an unpleasant emphasis, as though her knowing it made a part of her reason for being there. To Lily, the intonation sounded like a threat. "You found something belonging to me?" she asked, extending her hand. Mrs. Haffen drew back. "Well, if it comes to that, I guess it's mine as much as anybody's," she returned. Lily looked at her perplexedly. She was sure now that her visitor's manner conveyed a threat, but expert as she was in certain directions, there was nothing in her experience to prepare her for the exact significance of the present scene. She felt, however, that it must be ended as promptly as possible. "I don't understand. If this parcel is not mine, why have you asked for me?" The woman was unabashed by the question. She was evidently prepared to answer it, but like all her class, she had to go a long way back to make a beginning, and it was only after a pause that she replied, "My husband was janitor to the Benedict till the first of the month. Since then he can't get nothing to do." Lily remained silent, and she continued, "It wasn't no fault of our own, neither. The agent had another man he wanted the place for, and we was put out, bag and baggage, just to suit his fancy. I had a long sickness last winter, and an operation that ate up all we'd put by, and it's hard for me and the children, having been so long out of a job." After all, then, she had come only to ask Miss Bart to find a place for her husband, or, more probably, to seek the young lady's intervention with Mrs. Peniston. Lily had such an air of always getting what she wanted that she was used to being appealed to as an intermediary, and relieved of her vague apprehension, she took refuge in the conventional formula. "I'm sorry you've been in trouble," she said. "Oh, that we have, miss, and it's only just beginning. If only we'd got another situation, but the agent is dead against us. It ain't no fault of ours, neither, but—" At this point, Lily's impatience overcame her. "If you have anything to say to me," she interposed. The woman's resentment of the rebuff seemed to spur her lagging ideas. "Yes, miss, I'm coming to that," she said. She paused again with her eyes on Lily, and then continued in a tone of diffuse narrative. "When we was at the Benedict, I had charge of some of the gentlemen's rooms, leastways I swept 'em out on Saturdays. Some of the gentlemen got the greatest sight of letters, never saw the like of it. Their waste paper baskets would be fairly brimming and papers falling over on the floor. Maybe having so many is how they get so careless. Some of them is worse than others. Mr. Selden, Mr. Lawrence Selden, he was always one of the carefulest, burnt his letters in winter and tore 'em in little bits in summer. But sometimes he'd have so many he'd just bunch 'em together, the way the others did, and tear the lot through once, like this." While she spoke, she had loosened the string from the parcel in her hand, and now she drew forth a letter which she laid on the table between Miss Bart and herself. As she had said, the letter was torn in two, but with a rapid gesture she laid the torn edges together and smoothed out the page. A wave of indignation swept over Lily. She felt herself in the presence of something vile, as yet but dimly conjectured, the kind of vileness of which people whispered, but which she had never thought of as touching her own life. She drew back with a motion of disgust, but her withdrawal was checked by a sudden discovery. Under the glare of Mrs. Peniston's chandelier, she had recognised the handwriting of the letter. It was a large, disjointed hand, with a flourish of masculinity which but slightly disguised its rambling weakness. and the words, scrawled in heavy ink on pale-tinted notepaper, smote on Lily's ear as though she'd heard them spoken. At first she did not grasp the full import of the situation. She understood only that before her lay a letter written by Bertha Dorset and addressed, presumably, to Lawrence Selden. There was no date, but the blackness of the ink proved the writing to be comparatively recent. The packet in Mrs. Haffin's hand doubtless contained more letters of the same kind, a dozen, Lily conjectured, from its thickness. The letter before her was short, but its few words, which had leapt into her brain before she was conscious of reading them, told a long history, a history over which, for the last 4 years, the friends of the writer had smiled and shrugged, viewing it merely as one among the countless good situations of the mundane comedy. Now the other side presented itself to Lily, the volcanic nether side of the surface over which conjecture and innuendo glide so lightly till the first fissure turns their whisper to a shriek. Lily knew that there is nothing society resents so much as having given its protection to those who have not known how to profit by it. It is for having betrayed its connivance that the body social punishes the offender who is found out. And in this case there was no doubt of the issue. The code of Lily's world decreed that a woman's husband should be the only judge of her conduct. She was technically above suspicion while she had the shelter of his approval, or even of his indifference. But with a man of George Dorset's temper, there could be no thought of condemnation. The possessor of his wife's letters could overthrow with a touch the whole structure of her existence. And into what hands Bertha Dorset's secret had been delivered? For a moment, the irony of the coincidence tinged Lily's disgust with a confused sense of triumph. But the disgust prevailed. All her instinctive resistances of taste, of training, of blind inherited scruples, rose against the other feeling. Her strongest sense was one of personal contamination. She moved away, as though to put as much distance as possible between herself and her visitor. "I know nothing of these letters," she said. "I have no idea why you've brought them here." Mrs. Haffin faced her steadily. "I'll tell you why, miss. I brought them to you to sell, because I ain't got no other way of raising money. And if we don't pay our rent by tomorrow night, we'll be put out. I never done anything of the kind before, and if you'd speak to Mr. Selden or to Mr. Rosedale about getting Haffin taken on again at the Benedick, I seen you talking to Mr. Rosedale on the steps that day you come out of Mr. Selden's rooms." The blood rushed to Lily's forehead. She understood now. Mrs. Haffin supposed her to be the writer of the letters. In the first leap of her anger, she was about to ring and order the woman out. But an obscure impulse restrained her. The mention of Selden's name had started a new train of thought. Bertha Dorset's letters were nothing to her. They might go where the current of chance carried them. But Selden was inextricably involved in their fate. Men do not, at worst, suffer much from such exposure. And in this instance, the flash of divination which had carried the meaning of the letters to Lily's brain had revealed also that they were appeals, repeated, and therefore probably unanswered, for the renewal of a tie which time had evidently relaxed. Nevertheless, the fact that the correspondence had been allowed to fall into strange hands would convict Selden of negligence in a matter where the world holds it least pardonable. And there were graver risks to consider where a man of Dorset's ticklish balance was concerned. If she weighed all these things, it was unconsciously. She was aware only of feeling that Selden would wish the letters rescued, and that therefore she must obtain possession of them. Beyond that, her mind did not travel. She had indeed a quick vision of returning the packet to Bertha Dorset, and of the opportunities the restitution offered. But this thought lit up abysses from which she shrank back, ashamed. Meanwhile, Mrs. Haffin, prompt to perceive her hesitation, had already opened the packet and ranged its contents on the table. All the letters had been pieced together with strips of thin paper. Some were in small fragments, the others merely torn in half. Though there were not many, thus spread out they nearly covered the table. Lily's glance fell on a word here and there. Then she said in a low voice, "What do you wish me to pay you?" Mrs. Haffin's face reddened with satisfaction. It was clear that the young lady was badly frightened, and Mrs. Haffin was the woman to make the most of such fears. Anticipating an easier victory than she had foreseen, she named an exorbitant sum. But Miss Bard showed herself a less ready prey than might have been expected from her imprudent opening. She refused to pay the price named, and after a moment's hesitation, met it by a counter-offer of half the amount. Mrs. Haffin immediately stiffened. Her hand travelled toward the outspread letters, and folding them slowly, she made as though to restore them to their wrapping. "I guess they're worth more to you than to me, miss. But the poor has got to live as well as the rich," she observed sententiously. Lily was throbbing with fear, but the insinuation fortified her resistance. "You're mistaken," she said indifferently. "I have offered all I am willing to give for the letters, but there may be other ways of getting them." Mrs. Haffin raised a suspicious glance. She was too experienced not to know that the traffic she was engaged in had perils as great as its rewards, and she had a vision of the elaborate machinery of revenge which a word of this commanding young lady's might set in motion. She applied the corner of her shawl to her eyes, and murmured through it that no good came of bearing too hard on the poor, but that for her part she had never been mixed up in such a business before, and that on her honour as a Christian all she and Haffin had thought of was that the letters mustn't go any farther. Lily stood motionless, keeping between herself and the charwoman the greatest distance compatible with the need of speaking in low tones. The idea of bargaining for the letters was intolerable to her, but she knew that if she appeared to weaken, Mrs. Haffin would at once increase her original demand. She could never afterward recall how long the duel lasted, or what was the decisive stroke which finally, after a lapse of time recorded in minutes by the clock, in hours by the precipitate beat of her pulses, put her in possession of the letters. She knew only that the door had finally closed, and that she stood alone with the packet in her hand. She had no idea of reading the letters. Even to unfold Mrs. Haffin's dirty newspaper would have seemed degrading. But what did she intend to do with its contents? The recipient of the letters had meant to destroy them, and it was her duty to carry out his intention. She had no right to keep them. To do so was to lessen whatever merit lay in having secured their possession. But how destroy them so effectually that there should be no second risk of their falling in such hands? Mrs. Peniston's icy drawing-room grate shone with a forbidding lustre. The fire, like the lamps, was never lit except when there was company. Miss Bart was turning to carry the letters upstairs when she heard the opening of the outer door, and her aunt entered the drawing-room. Mrs. Peniston was a small, plump woman with a colourless skin lined with trivial wrinkles. Her grey hair was arranged with precision, and her clothes looked excessively new, and yet slightly old-fashioned. They were always black and tightly fitting, with an expensive glitter. She was the kind of woman who wore jet at breakfast. Lily had never seen her when she was not cuirassed in shining black, with small, tight boots, and an air of being packed and ready to start. Yet she never started. She looked about the drawing-room with an expression of minute scrutiny. "I saw a streak of light under one of the blinds as I drove up. It's extraordinary that I can never teach that woman to draw them down evenly." Having corrected the irregularity, she seated herself on one of the glossy purple armchairs. Mrs. Peniston always sat on a chair, never in it. Then she turned her glance to Miss Bart. "My dear, you look tired. I suppose it's the excitement of the wedding. Cornelia Van Alstyne was full of it. Molly was there, and Gertie Farish ran in for a minute to tell us about it. I think it was odd their serving melons before the consommé. A wedding breakfast should always begin with consommé. Molly didn't care for the bridesmaids' dresses. She had it straight from Julia Melson that they cost $300 apiece at Celeste, but she says they didn't look it. I'm glad you decided not to be a bridesmaid. That shade of salmon pink wouldn't have suited you." Mrs. Peniston delighted in discussing the minutest details of festivities in which she had not taken part. Nothing would have induced her to undergo the exertion and fatigue of attending the Van Arsberg wedding, but so great was her interest in the event that, having heard two versions of it, she now prepared to extract a third from her niece. Lily, however, had been deplorably careless in noting the particulars of the entertainment. She had failed to observe the colour of Mrs. Van Osburgh's gown, and could not even say whether the old Van Osburgh serve had been used at the bride's table. Mrs. Pennison, in short, found that she was of more service as a listener than as a narrator.
"Really, Lily, I don't see why you took the trouble to go to the wedding, if you don't remember what happened or whom you saw there. When I was a girl, I used to keep the menu of every dinner I went to, and write the names of the people on the back. And I never threw away my cotillion favours till after your uncle's death, when it seemed unsuitable to have so many coloured things about the house. I had a whole closet full, I remember, and I can tell to this day what balls I got them at. Molly Van Alstyne reminds me of what I was at that age. It's wonderful how she notices. She was able to tell her mother exactly how the wedding dress was cut, and we knew at once, from the fold in the back, that it must have come from Paquin."
Mrs. Peniston rose abruptly, and advancing to the ormolu clock, surrounded by a helmeted Minerva, which throned on the chimney-piece between two malachite vases, passed her lace handkerchief between the helmet and its visor.
"I knew it. The parlour-maid never dusts there," she exclaimed, triumphantly displaying a minute spot on the handkerchief.
Then, reseating herself, she went on,
"Molly thought Mrs. Dorset the best-dressed woman at the wedding. I've no doubt her dress did cost more than anyone else's, but I can't quite like the idea, a combination of sable and point de Milan. It seems she goes to a new man in Paris who won't take an order until his client has spent a day with him at his villa at Neuilly. He says he must study his subject's home life, a most peculiar arrangement, I should say. But Mrs. Dorset told Molly about it herself. She said the villa was full of the most exquisite things, and she was really sorry to leave. Molly said she never saw her looking better. She was in tremendous spirits, and said she had made a match between Evie Van Osburgh and Percy Gryce. She really seems to have a very good influence on young men. I hear she's interesting herself now in that silly Silverton boy who has had his head turned by Carrie Fisher and has been gambling so dreadfully. Well, as I was saying, Evie is really engaged. Mrs. Dorset had her to stay with Percy Gryce and managed it all. And Grace Van Osburgh is in the seventh heaven. She had almost despaired of marrying Evie."
Mrs. Peniston again paused, but this time her scrutiny addressed itself not to the furniture, but to her niece. "Cornelia Van Alstyne was so surprised. She had heard that you were to marry young Gryce. She saw the Wetherills just after they had stopped with you at Bellamont, and Alice Wetherill was quite sure there was an engagement. She said that when Mr. Gryce left unexpectedly one morning, they all thought he had rushed to town for the ring." Lily rose and moved toward the door. "I believe I am tired. I think I'll go to bed," she said. And Mrs. Peniston, suddenly distracted by the discovery that the easel sustaining the late Mr. Peniston's crayon portrait was not exactly in line with the sofa in front of it, presented an absent-minded brow to her kiss. In her own room, Lily turned up the gas jet and glanced toward the grate. It was as brilliantly polished as the one below, but here at least she could burn a few papers with less risk of incurring her aunt's disapproval. She made no immediate motion to do so, however, but dropping into a chair, looked wearily about her. Her room was large and comfortably furnished. It was the envy and admiration of poor Grace Stepney, who boarded. But contrasted with the light tints and luxurious appointments of the guest rooms where so many weeks of Lily's existence were spent, it seemed as dreary as a prison. The monumental wardrobe and bedstead of black walnut had migrated from Mr. Peniston's bedroom, and the magenta flock wallpaper, of a pattern dear to the early 60s, was hung with large steel engravings of anecdotic character. Lily had tried to mitigate this charmless background by a few frivolous touches in the shape of a lace-decked toilet table and a little painted desk surmounted by photographs. But the futility of the attempt struck her as she looked about the room. What a contrast to the subtle elegance of the setting she had pictured for herself! An apartment which should surpass the complicated luxury of her friend's surroundings by the whole extent of that artistic sensibility which made her feel herself their superior, in which every tint and line should combine to enhance her beauty and give distinction to her leisure. Once more, the haunting sense of physical ugliness was intensified by her mental depression, so that each piece of the offending furniture seemed to thrust forth its most aggressive angle. Her aunt's words had told her nothing new, but they had revived the vision of Bertha Dorset, smiling, flattered, victorious, holding her up to ridicule by insinuations intelligible to every member of their little group. The thought of the ridicule struck deeper than any other sensation. Lily knew every turn of the elusive jargon which could flay its victims without the shedding of blood. Her cheek burned at the recollection, and she rose and caught up the letters. She no longer meant to destroy them. That intention had been effaced by the quick corrosion of Mrs. Peniston's words. Instead, she approached her desk, and lighting a taper, tied and sealed the packet. Then she opened the wardrobe, drew out a dispatch box, and deposited the letters within it. As she did so, it struck her with a flash of irony that she was indebted to Gus Trenor for the means of buying them. Chapter 10. The autumn dragged on monotonously. Miss Bart had received one or two notes from Judy Trenor, reproaching her for not returning to Bellamont, but she replied evasively, alleging the obligation to remain with her aunt. In truth, however, she was fast wearying of her solitary existence with Mrs. Peniston, and only the excitement of spending her newly acquired money lightened the dullness of the days. All her life Lily had seen money go out as quickly as it came in, and whatever theories she cultivated as to the prudence of setting aside a part of her gains, she had, unhappily, no saving vision of the risks of the opposite course. It was a keen satisfaction to feel that, for a few months at least, she would be independent of her friend's bounty, that she could show herself abroad without wondering whether some penetrating eye would detect in her dress the traces of Judy Trenor's refurbished splendour. The fact that the money freed her temporarily from all minor greater one it represented, and having never before known what it was to command so large a sum, she lingered delectably over the amusement of spending it. It was on one of these occasions that, leaving a shop where she had spent an hour of deliberation over a dressing case of the most complicated elegance, she ran across Miss Farish, who had entered the same establishment with the modest object of having her watch repaired. Lily was feeling unusually virtuous. She had decided to defer the purchase of the dressing-case till she should receive the bill for her new opera cloak, and the resolve made her feel much richer than when she had entered the shop. In this mood of self-approval, she had a sympathetic eye for others, and she was struck by her friend's air of dejection. Miss Farish, it appeared, had just left the committee meeting of a struggling charity in which she was interested. The object of the association was to provide comfortable lodgings with a reading room and other modest distractions, where young women of the class employed in downtown offices might find a home when out of work or in need of rest, and the first year's financial report showed so deplorably small a balance that Miss Farish, who was convinced of the urgency of the work, felt proportionately disappointed.